18-month-old daughter. Yeah. So yeah, brilliant. So certainly keeping us on our toes at the moment.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah, good fun. Very good fun.
And you know that single girl.
The hairline sort of making a run for the back of the head. In the beard.
It'll come. Don't you worry. Don't you worry. Now we had the joys of half term, and then yesterday morning we got a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, and they both woke up with a temperature.
Oh my god, it's bad, isn't it?
So they both stayed home all day, but luckily they've gone to school nursery today.
Have you got boys and girls, or
a boy and a girl?
Boy and girl. Yeah. Who is the boy? The oldest or the youngest?
Yeah, he is the oldest. Yeah.
So the same gap as us, 2 years.
2 years.
I feel like my 1-year-old daughter's already outwitting my 3-year-old son. it's
fair to say our daughter, the youngest daughter, she's pretty street smart already.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's definitely an element of she knows the crack. Well, thanks for coming in anyway.
It's honestly a pleasure.
Didn't keep him busy. Good. Right. Well, we'll kick off.
Close enough? Should I?
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell, episode 47. It's nice to be joined by, firstly, Sam Boot, who's a super sub for James Hughes, who's been struck down by some vicious man flu, unfortunately. Can or can't confirm whether it was associated with our ski trip to Norway last week, but he came off somewhat worse for wear, so he's resting at home. So thanks, Sam, for joining us.
No problem at all.
And equally delighted, if not more delighted, to be joined by Callum Pickering. Callum, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Callum's chief economist at Peel Hunt, the UK investment bank. Distinguished career in economic analysis and forecasting spans over a decade. He writes a column for the Daily Telegraph, regularly appears on Bloomberg, CNBC and BBC, has written for the Evening Standard and City AM, frequently interacts with policymakers, including the Prime Minister's economics team, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank and the EU Commission. Prior to joining Peel Hunt, he worked as senior economist for Berenberg Bank, holds a bachelor's economics degree from the University of Sheffield and a master's degree in economics from the University of Warwick. So Callum, fine CV, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I had Piece in the Spectator as well for the first time this year, so it's called What's Wrong with the UK Economy?
We'll get to that. We'll get to that.
You have it.
That's on the agenda, don't you worry. there's lots to talk about, clearly, and as we sort of discussed in the intro, really. I mean, UK politics and policy is one thing, but it's been a fascinating start to the year, and perhaps not one that anyone had anticipated. The first, second, third week of January, whatever it was, we had the launch of a Chinese AI large language model, which put some of the US tech names under the cosh, shall we say. And more broadly, we have got the US equity market is actually the worst performing of the major equity indices so far year to date. This was done to last night's close. I would say as we speak, the US equity market is probably down year to date, given that we're down about 1% today, whereas Europe flying high, up around 10% so far, driven by that speculative stock known as Rheinmetall, the German defence name that's up, 60% or something year to date. So, pretty extraordinary scenes. Just on DeepSeek, you wrote a few things on that. Have you got any sort of views as to how that will sort of impact the whole US exceptionalism, tech giant leaders kind of thing?
Well, I think it's just worth, from an economics point of view, just saying a few things about AI. When you think about a technology, ask first, is it a complement to labour or is it a substitute for labour?
Mm-hmm.
So take something very straightforward, like advanced robotics in manufacturing, that's a substitute for labour. A tool, a hammer, a chisel, that's a complement for labour. And across heavy industry, agriculture, we have lots of substitutes for labour. Almost all previous industrial revolutions were introducing substitute technologies. But with services, especially high-end services like law, banking, consultancy, we have computers, we have the internet. That's a complement to labour, but it's not a proper substitute. Right. So with AI, you potentially have this opportunity for genuine capital deepening. And so when I think about AI, potentially the most exciting aspect is, and to be blunt, both of these things cannot be true at the same time. One, labor shortages due to an aging population in services-oriented economies, and AI causing mass unemployment in services economies.
Yeah.
Actually, conveniently, those problems actually suit each other. Yeah. So this is the macro view. Now, when you think about AI, we're right at the start of this technological arc, and typically right at the start of any technology, you're at the brute force stage. It's very expensive to produce. Often it's quite big. Mm. It's usually very energy intensive. And for that reason, you tend to anticipate, and just think about the size of computers in the 1950s or the 1960s, like these huge rooms. Like
rooms,
rooms full of computers. Yeah, yeah. And then what happens over time is you put so much capital and so much energy, and you accept that you can't do this with these commodities because you want to succeed in this transformative technology. You put so much into it that eventually you get breakthroughs, mm-hmm. and the capital technology becomes smaller, it becomes more energy efficient. And when we think about DeepSeek, and you know, I let me just red herring here. I had a conversation with a friend. I said, like, you know, he asked me about DeepSeek, and I said, you know, why is Italian American food worse than Italian food? And it's because you have so few ingredients in it. You had scarcity. Right. Southern Italy, it's onions, it's aubergines, it's tomatoes, and suddenly you get all this amazing stuff. In America, you have too much cheese, and so everything. So the excess is not what you need. So scarcity creates innovation. And so with DeepSeek, two things have happened. First, America has decided we'll try to throttle the Chinese AI industry by limiting chips and limiting the quality chips that we send. And this has introduced scarcity. The scarcity has produced this innovation. And so now we have DeepSeek, which has accelerated this process. We think, assuming it does what we think it does, has accelerated this process towards less capital intensive, less energy intensive AI, mm-hmm. which paradoxically doesn't reduce the overall capital expenditure and energy consumption linked to AI, but it actually broadens it, and it allows more firms that potentially wouldn't have been able to move up this technological curve as quickly as they once thought to move up quickly. So I see that the market has reacted negatively, at least in the US. It's downgraded its capital expenditure expectations, but broadly, actually, more companies can now get involved sooner. So I think this speaks to a bigger technology cycle.
The Jevons paradox.
Mm. Jevons paradox, yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, we're gonna name drop a few of those today. that's good. Do you think the whole DeepSeek thing, does it undermine potentially that kind of American exceptionalism thing that everyone has been talking about forever? Particularly with regards to the stock market.
In this cycle, it has the potential to, and I'm suggesting in this cycle because I'm not an analyst, I'm not a portfolio manager, I'm an economist. So when I think about markets, I typically don't think about markets on a 1 month view or even a 1 year view. I tend to lean back. And if we think about markets, say over the last 50 years, there are three very, very distinct phases. Mm-hmm. And the phase typically goes, the world faces a problem, America solves it, it benefits from that solution, it becomes relatively too expensive, the rest of the world starts using the technology or using the solution that America has introduced, it then starts to benefit, then you go through this cycle again, and so you can walk through this story. In the 1970s, what was the major problem? Oil, hydrocarbons, because of the two OPEC-inflicted recessions on the Western world. Very severe inflationary recession, 1979 in the US. Yeah. The reaction was Reaganism, deregulation, and oil exploration in the US. Now, always keep in your mind here through the story, the dollar on an inflation-adjusted basis. The dollar starts to appreciate dramatically into the middle of the 1980s when everyone gets excited about the US. This is Reaganism phase one.
Yeah.
Other parts of the world, including the UK, look very weak, dire in fact. By the second half of the 80s, actually, the Western world is benefiting from the fact that global hydrocarbon markets are much more stable, thanks to America, largely. And in the UK, you have the Big Bang deregulation, you have the Thatcher policies are starting to kick in, and the UK starts to do well, other countries start to do well, and the dollar weakens in real terms. It's not that we sell the US market, it's just that some reallocation happens away. That lasts right until the early 90s. Then through the early 90s until 2001, you get excitement over the first wave of tech, It's the companies we know. It's Microsoft. It's Google. That's the first wave. It's computers. And I should mention here, just when it comes to the internet, why you should be a bit cautious listening to economists when it comes to technology. Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winner, famously said, "I think history will show that the internet had no bigger bearing on economies than the fax machine." Turned out to be wrong. But that lasted until 2001. Then, of course, we all know how expensive the US got. The US economy did well in the late 90s, but then it starts to moderate through the early 2000s, the UK, peripheral Europe, other countries that can use the technology. So you get the innovation through the 90s to the early 2000s in the US. You then get the diffusion around the rest of the world until the global financial crisis.
And that was emerging markets, China. Really,
I was going to say, how much of that was noughties. China entering the WHO?
Oh,
sorry, the WTO.
China plays a part in this in the sense that it introduced a lot of cheap capital goods into the world. But just think about, say, US versus other advanced markets in Europe. Europe in the early 2000s is doing really, really well. Economically, they have a boom after the euro is introduced. That lasts until 2008-09. You have the balance sheet recession, the global financial crisis. America fixes its banks. It broadly follows sensible regulatory policy, doesn't over-regulate in the way we did in the UK. And then starting sort of 2012-13, we start to get excited about tech. What happens here is, just as in 2001, sorry I didn't mention it, the real dollar peaked. Early 2000s, the dollar is weakening. Yeah. It reaches a low in 2009. It then starts to appreciate, and we've had this real appreciation in the dollar as the US markets outperformed. We've had this innovation in AI, and now suddenly we're asking, which are the countries that look cheap versus the US can start to benefit from the technology that the US has introduced to the world? And this is normally where you start to see, on an inflation-adjusted basis, the dollar weaken as we reallocate from US to other parts of the world.
I was just going to jump ahead a little bit there, because you mentioned the dollar in the 80s, and of course in 85 or 86 we had the Plaza Accord, which led essentially, or was the catalyst for, a lot of dollar weakness in the late 80s. There's a bit of talk about a so-called Mar-a-Lago Accord. Trump has got his mind set on weakening the dollar to improve US manufacturing competitiveness. Is that something that you foresee, or will it happen naturally out of this sort of rebalancing and diffusion that you talked about?
My call at the beginning of the year was initially dollar strong and then dollar gradually weak. Speed with which it weakens depends a lot on whether the US remains stable but returns to something like normal growth, or whether we get a cyclical downside surprise, and I'm nervous about the latter. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the policies of the new president, I would make two remarks. It's still early days. The first is, in a sense, I think it's wrong that people say he is unpredictable. In many respects, he's very predictable. He does almost exactly what he says. And so if you say something, we should pay attention. So that's one thing that stands out. The second thing is, there's actually a common thread in the way that the US is approaching policy, which is, imagine that the US president, Donald Trump, is not the president, but he's the CEO of corporate USA. Then all the policy decisions start to make sense. Lower taxes help the bottom line. Deregulation help the bottom line. A trade balance isn't a reflection of the relative imbalances between demand and supply, US versus its trading partners. But as far as I can tell, Donald Trump thinks this is a profit or loss on a corporate statement, which it's not. Think about the signal that we had earlier this week that last week, that the US may want to refinance its debt, introduce some longer bonds. That sounds a lot like a debt restructuring. You have a company with too much debt, the first thing you do is you do a debt restructuring. And so the framework here is, just imagine that the government is being run by a board and Donald Trump is CEO, and a lot of these policies start to make sense. I'm not a fan of the US's trade policies. In some respects, there is a fundamental problem. So mal trade practices with, say, China or some emerging markets absolutely need to be addressed, no question. But the outsized growth that the US enjoys is, in a way, the reason why it runs the trade deficit. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, the US does not produce enough domestic goods and services relative to demand, which is consumers plus government, and the government is running large deficits. So the government is artificially adding to demand. But since the US is the biggest, most dynamic economy and has the dollar, it can easily attract those capital flows to suck in the money, to finance that excess demand. And so that simply gets reflected on the trade balance. The only way to reduce the trade balance is to either shrink the government deficit, so reduce the government consumption part, dramatically raise domestic production, but that's difficult in the short run, or make consumers poorer, which is what tariffs do.
Which is not what your voters want.
And presumably also assumes a kind of, you know, going back to the Reagan era, you know, the idea of supply chains was so different then to what they are now, in that, you know, things could cross borders three or four times before they're a final good, and it's at what point do the tariffs get implemented? And I think, you know, it's far more complex and intertwined than it was, you know, 40 years ago. And he seems to kind of potentially be overlooking that.
That's right. I mean, that's where there's there appears to be an inconsistency between the pro-growth deregulation agenda and the pro-growth tax cuts and even DOGE. And the tariff policy, until you imagine that we're not looking at these as economists, but we're looking at these as a board analyzing a business. And then suddenly you misinterpret what the US trade balance actually means. I must admit, I've been surprised by the strength of the US economy, as everyone has over the last few years, but I'm quite nervous about the US this year, partly because of the nature of the underlying dynamic in the US economy. You have, do the easy stuff first. If you look at residential activity, global trade, US international trade, industrial production, it's not quite as weak as it is in Europe, but it's weak. It's really, really weak. Business investment actually isn't all that strong. What you have in the US is, over the past 2-3 years, and just for perspective here, the Fed thinks the potential growth in the US is around 1.9%, which is good by European standards.
Yeah,
the
US has been gangbusters, though, is it?
It's not gangbusters, but US has been drifting at 3. Yeah. This is good numbers. Yeah. But it's driven by a self-reinforcing cycle of large US deficits, government deficits, which, drawing capital from abroad, spending the domestic economy, lifts incomes, it lifts the stock market. Because the stock market is elevated, US consumers feel wealthy, household net wealth is at an all-time high. The savings rate of households in the US is a little over 3%. Normal is, let's say, 5. So this reinforcing cycle of strong government demand, a stock market that is abnormally valued to the upside, and consumers feeling like they can spend every dollar they earn, almost every dollar they earn, because they've never been wealthier, means that if anything undermines this, whether it's a normalization in the household savings rate, a rise in bond yields that adds to discount rates and pricks the bubble in US stock markets, or the government that finds actually it's made a misstep with DOGE or they can't pass a budget, anything could potentially go wrong here. What you find is this dynamic is undermined. The other thing to keep in mind is confidence is such an important part of all three of these drivers: the stock market, the consumer, and confidence in the US government. If that confidence is undermined, and we've already seen by now what looks to be a fairly pronounced weakening of domestic economic data in the US, whether it's consumer confidence that we saw today or the services PMIs, the Atlanta Fed GDP Now estimate, I have not checked it today, it might be out, but last week they revised it down from almost 4% annualized in Q1 to close to 2% annualized. That's quite a big drop off. Economies are cyclical because of this inconsistency between underlying fundamentals and expectations. So if everyone expects the economy to do well and they raise their orders too much and they borrow too much, and then underlying that is a sudden reckoning, very quickly you don't go back to the sort of 2% growth of the market and we are looking for, but you actually have a cyclical undershoot for a while. So I'm nervous that this process starts to play out. And I think just to you know, finish that point on, it's very, very difficult for the Fed with such high levels of inflation to goose the economy and goose the market. In 2022, when the US market corrected, the Biden administration introduced the Infrastructure Act, the CHIPS Act, the Jobs Act, and increased the structural deficit in the US by 3 percentage points,
yeah.
essentially just pushed the market back up.
Yeah.
I don't know how you can repeat that process.
Yeah, and that point about the low household savings rate and a booming stock market, and of course American households have got a lot higher proportion of their net worth in the stock market. So a high stock market has a much bigger impact on consumer confidence, which has a big impact on spending and the economy in general. You know, I think your point probably is that it doesn't take much to kick one of those kind of legs out. Anything can happen, and you know, stuff that we can't foresee happens all the time. And all of a sudden, that can go into reverse quite quickly. If the stock market's down 10-15%, savings rates drift higher. Presumably, consumer spending falls quite quickly at that point, and they're not growing at 3%. They're probably growing at naught. Is that?
That's cyclical dynamics.
And the government start closing the deficit as well, which effectively takes money out of the economy. Right?
Correct. I mean, the thing is with this is the unique. What is different this time around with Donald Trump is that Doge is, to a large extent, Thatcherism.
Mm-hmm.
That is, so you know, when we think about the kind of pro-market, pro-business governments that, you know, ideally, fund managers say, well, we would have this kind of government around the world, and markets would go up and economies would be dynamic. You think about Thatcherism and Reaganism, because they happened together, but they were very, very different. Reaganism was aggressive deregulation,
mm-hmm.
and tax cuts financed by deficit spending. Right. That was Trump episode one. Thatcherism was deregulation with aggressive government spending cuts, which then allowed the tax base to fall.
Right. Okay.
This time around, with Doge, potentially you have aggressive spending cuts,
yeah.
which will have an impact on US aggregate demand.
Yeah.
It will only be net neutral if any corresponding tax cuts or deregulation provide an offset. And just a small anecdote here, the reason why the trust budget failed is because fundamentally there was a confusion between Reaganism and Thatcherism.
Okay.
They claimed to be doing Thatcherism, but they were not. They were doing Reaganism, but for Reaganism, you need the dollar.
Deficit finance.
It can't be a small open economy.
Yeah. Reaganism without the dollar does not work.
Okay.
Which was ultimately the fault in that budget. It's not that taxes aren't too high. That's not the argument. It's just that to get taxes down, the UK, because the laws of economics apply to medium advanced open economies like the UK, they do eventually to the US, but they can stretch them for a while. They can bend them for a while. Biggest bond market sell-off in modern history, inflation rising to 11%, and, you know, big supply shock, and huge energy crisis, and the UK government says, okay, we're going to cut taxes and finance it by debt. Like, it's just not going to wash.
Mm.
So if Trump does enact tax cuts or extension to previous cuts and things, you don't think that will be an unleashing of animal spirits, or do you think that's largely kind of already priced into sentiment, and so that's not going to have the effect?
So, I mean, to be clear, my base case is not US recession. I just think you can see a clear recession risk this year.
Scott's going to put the Citigroup do an economic surprise index for, we've got the UK here in blue, US in yellow, and Europe in whatever that is, grey. And we can see, if you look at the chart, on the yellow line on the right-hand side of the chart, is the yellow line is the US, which is the only one going down, which basically means that the economic data is coming in lower than people's expectations, i.e. it's missing after a prolonged period of beating. This is a naturally mean reverting series,
that's right,
clearly. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting how the UK and Europe, the data is maybe less bad than what economists like Callum feared,
yeah.
and in the US it's coming in less good than what economists had hoped for.
That's right.
Fair to say.
Yeah.
So that's part of the kind of puzzle as to why we've seen both Europe and UK equities do relatively well year to date, and the US perhaps a little bit weaker. Is that?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, in a sense, sentiment and expectations tend to correlate, but they're almost always offside relative to fundamentals, and whether they're offside positive or offside negative generally tells you the risk mood in markets.
Yeah.
The reason why my base case is the US returns to something resembling trend is, it's true the government's running large deficits, but as you mentioned, there are plans to extend taxes and extend these deficits. And actually around the US economy, I don't see major excesses. You don't have piles of inventory, you don't have excess capital investment, you don't have an oversupply of housing.
There's no credit bubble.
There's no credit bubble. And so even if the economy rolls over, you can see the basis for a fairly quick stabilization.
Balance sheets are in strong.
That's exactly right, yeah. And, you know, I'm probably in that scenario where suddenly the US looked like it would undershoot, the Fed would be able to go, yeah. I've got, you know, Fed going a couple of times this year, 50 more basis points in cuts. What I think isn't going to be necessary, though, for this story to play out is that trade wars are taken off the table in a major way, probably within around 6 months. Mm-hmm. Because if you can take that risk off the table, of course, let's see what happens with geopolitics, but it looks like we're heading at least to an end of a Russia-Ukraine conflict at some point, then the market will be able to take off significant inflation risk, and it will allow then the US government to at least maintain this deficit for a little bit longer. So you'll get some further demand promoting policies. You know, when it comes to this issue of trade wars, I'm clearly the situation is very risky. But when I look at the underlying incentives of US, China, Europe, I see a very different world to 2018 when all three could wear a trade war for 2.5 years. And so if you there's this kind of rule where if you tell me the incentives, I'll tell you the outcome. Mm-hmm. The incentives point towards escalation and quick resolution, I think. I mean, I'm happy to talk through that if you like.
Go on then.
Because
like Trump seems to be incentivized by doing a deal, and he kind of likes the idea.
Yes.
Some sort of grand bargain is what I sort of mentioned about the Mar-a-Lago Accord type idea. That's his kind of idea, and he seems to be keen on getting a Nobel Peace Prize as well.
Yeah,
whatever he's doing to the Ukrainians.
Let's if you can. Of course, we just to decompartmentalize a little bit. Let's just park the geopolitics and just look specifically on the issue of trade. This is the way the world looked in 2018. Was it February when it was X. It's X formerly Twitter. Mm-hmm. But it was trade wars are good and easy to win or whatever it was. And then we had the steel tariffs a few days later, and then we play through this. Now, in 2018, think about the three major players, US, EU, China. US has a low interest rate environment, mm-hmm. A bond market which is completely tranquilized still by QE. It's actually true for the world. Low inflation, deficit around 3%, and an economy which is enjoying a cyclical upswing on the back of Trump's initial tax cuts and deregulation.
Yeah.
So if you look at the ISM trade data, exports and imports indexes, it completely falls off a cliff. But because the underlying economy is so strong and you have this low inflation environment, bond markets are relaxed, the US can wear it. What else is true in Europe? Industrial production is at an all-time high. Mm-hmm. Trade is at an all-time high. Russian gas is still flowing cheaply, yes. Demand from China is still fairly strong at that point, and Europe is feeling unified. The EU is feeling unified because of Brexit. China, in the last wave of fast growth, mm-hmm. consumer confidence is still high, the real estate bubble had not yet fully popped, global trade was strong. So when the US starts this trade war, Europe, completely caught out, why is this supposed ally picking a fight with us, stands its ground. China takes the view, sensibly, because the consensus was eventually China will overtake the US economically. The US is now just escalating while it still has its relative and absolute advantage. Mm-hmm. So they kind of play hardball. They strike a piecemeal deal here and there, but not properly. That then just escalates. You get this tit for tat tariff escalation, right basically up until COVID, which intercepts this. This time around, and again, sorry to just go around the world, but I think it's helpful. We've discussed the US, you have this underlying fragility linked to the fact that the bond market has to stay calm, mm-hmm. and tariffs introduce either growth or inflation risks. Mm-hmm. Pick which one. Europe has now a chronic decline in industrial production, especially in Germany. You have political disenchantment.
Yeah.
Take the German election result.
Yeah.
You no longer have cheap and secure energy. instead of strong Chinese demand, you have intensifying competition in EVs. In China, you have now all of the characteristics of what seems to be a liquidity trap, which is low inflation, low interest rates, not lifting credit demand, chronic pessimism, problems dealing with the real estate and capital misallocation.
2008 all over again.
2008. Lots of excess capacity.
Yep.
So both Europe and China would benefit from a strong recovery in global trade.
Yep.
The US probably can't sustain, can't wear a long trade war just because it needs the bond market, if nothing else, to pass a tax cut. And so you basically have this situation where, in a way, again, predictably, Donald Trump, he wants to shock and awe Europe, China, hopefully into some deals. I think this potentially gets wrapped up within 6 months. If we get some, let's call them resolutions, not solutions, on geopolitics, what you're probably staring into is a world where, yes, the US gets the bond market to play nice on a tax cut, Europe eases a little more, China continues to ease, and finally after, well, we haven't had one since 2019, you get a proper industrial cycle, you get a proper global trade cycle, which is really the missing part for global markets. When we think about narrow leadership in markets around US tech, we've discussed AI, but on the flip side, it's US mid-cap, US small-cap, Europe, Asia, all of these heavy industry indexes are basically suffering because you've not had a proper global trade and industrial cycle. And so I, as worried as I am about the US now, I'm also thinking, well, I can see a pathway to a proper market cycle into the second half of the year.
We're sort of beginning to see a little bit, like European financials and cyclicals have started this year in particular to move, haven't they? So you could potentially, back to your point,
that's it.
The banks are in really good condition from a, you know, liquidity and as capital standpoint. We've not had excessive loan growth. You can see how things could move for the better. And that brings me somewhat neatly on to the doomerism that's been emanating from Whitehall. I mean, what are they thinking? What are they thinking? And is the change of tone that we've seen in the last 6 weeks? We've actually got some charts which I borrowed from your. So let's start here. So, you know, UK and European GDP has been pretty dire in comparison to the US, which has done a lot more, in particular, not just since the financial crisis, but actually more so since the pandemic.
Yep.
We've had a confidence shock. So we've got consumers and business confidence on this chart here, which have both taken a bit of a downturn, which coincided pretty much with the budget. Was that fair to say?
Yep.
National insurance, you know, if you keep telling people things are going to get worse, then people think they're going to get worse. But on the flip side of that, we do have low unemployment, which is the black line on the left-hand chart here, and we've got high employment, admittedly perhaps not as high as it might be because of the number of people out of work, economically inactive, I should say, and earnings, which is the right-hand chart, in nominal terms in black and in real terms have actually gone up a bit as well. So this point that wages in the UK are growing 4 or 5% and inflation is 3%, okay, it might go a little bit higher, but real wages are growing. So, you know, you can see that the UK economy fundamentally is pretty solid, but the chart on the left here, I think, is the one that, that, you know, tells its tale. So the green line here is real household disposable income, i.e. how much people are getting paid, and the darker line is consumption. And the difference between the two essentially is, you know, if your wages are growing by more than your spending, then your savings are going up kind of by default, because you can either spend money or save money. So, I mean, is it fair to say, can the blame, if you like, for the elevated savings rate in the UK be put squarely at the new government's door?
Yes, there's that the government has, with its communication, injected a needless sense of foreboding and apprehension in consumers that have fundamentally strong starting positions, whether that's from a labour market, a wage perspective, or a balance sheet perspective. Yeah. And since so much of a business cycle, an upswing, is determined by just the spontaneous urge to spend and invest, it's always just a little frustrating from the position of an economist to just look at an economy with okay fundamentals and then to not see any growth. I mean, what we have actually in the UK, I think, is a serious case of kind of PTSD. We've had 10 years of highly unusual shocks, and the result of that is we're much more sensitive to downside surprises than we normally would be. But also, we've the succession of shocks has reduced growth expectations so much to the extent that in a sort of there's this idea that if you create the supply, the demand will be there. So it's kind of Say's law, supply creates demand. But I think also the reverse is true, which is a lack of demand creates a lack of supply. So if consumers can spend and businesses have the cash on their balance sheets and their corporate debt levels are low and the external supply environment is normalized, you know, energy expensive, but we can get the energy and we can get the capital goods. You know, you have this paradoxical environment where the lack of willingness to spend is also creating the lack of willingness to invest. I think there's just a couple of points to make. Could you actually go back to the chart where we see the levels of real GDP between the UK and the US? The next one, perfect. So if you look at this story, what you see actually is the UK is actually doing fairly well right up until...
Up until the pandemic.
Yeah, up until the pandemic.
It's tracking the US.
Well, you actually see a slight kink in 2018, mm-hmm. which is when we start to do with trade wars. So a couple of things to note if we just compare the UK and the US line. The US imports about 10% of its GDP.
Mm-hmm.
The UK imports a bit more than 30% of its GDP.
Right.
The UK is also a net importer of energy.
Yeah.
The US is a net exporter of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Through the past 4 years, we've also had a higher inflation peak and persistence.
Yes.
Until recently, where the US, absolutely right, the US inflation is now running a bit hotter than the UK. So when we think about the underlying demand and supply here, what you actually see is the US, because it has a larger share of domestic production,
mm-hmm.
which is the inverse of that import ratio that I mentioned, and is a net exporter of energy. With COVID and the supply disruptions to shipping, and with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the global disruptions to gas markets, what you don't have in the US is a huge mismatch between domestic demand, which is growing nicely, and supply. Domestic, there's an external bit, which is the inflation. Whereas in the UK, if you were to look at the UK versus the US economy in nominal terms, so in cash terms,
yeah.
you see very little difference between the two lines.
Right.
All the difference is in the real, which is, say, everything is on the supply side. So we're
okay.
impaired by trade wars starting 2018, we're impaired through COVID and the external dislocations, and we've been hit more by the gas shock and actually the commodity shock.
And leaving the EU.
But that's more of a structural problem than a one-off shock,
mm-hmm.
and so you can explain this difference just between the underlying makeup of the two economies and the exposure to the external environment,
yeah.
which is why, and you're remembering my reason for being optimistic early last year, and actually mostly justified was, well, if this external environment is normalized and if the kind of weird supply shocks are fading. And consumers continue to spend, you'll actually just see in real terms the economy will spring back to life, which is roughly what happened. Now, that's where the disappointment comes in the second half of last year.
So if we go back to the Economic Surprise Index and we look at the first half of 2024, the blue line goes up in a straight line through
exactly right.
spring of 2024, and it probably peaks around the time the election was called, right?
That's exactly right, it peaks. And what you should have seen is that initial spurt of recovery growth
yeah.
turn into
something more sustainable. Yeah.
But the problem is when you've had net, of course, with huge gyrations, virtually no economic growth between 2019 and the end of 2023, expectations for GDP growth come down significantly.
Mm-hmm.
So I can come up with a potential growth forecast for the UK, which, without doing too many intellectual pirouettes, gets me to around 1.6%, which is not far away from where the OBR or the Bank of England are, actually. But most market participants say this anecdotally, you say, well, growth is probably, you know, mere decimal points,
yeah.
maybe 1%,
yeah.
which means you need to go through a period of normality where confidence returns, businesses invest, households spend, to then see that growth can be sustainably higher, for then expectations to go up, for then the business cycle to kick on. And so what we needed to see in the second half of last year was that initial green shoot of recovery linked to this improving supply environment. Because actually, again, there's so much we can learn from that period. I mean, we raised interest rates by more than 500 basis
and
points.
And we didn't have a recession.
And the mountains are still standing.
I know.
It's the same as true in the US. That's exactly right.
It's extraordinary, really.
We should explain why this is the case. And I spent a lot of time trying to understand why demand had actually been so resilient. So once you made the case that demand had been resilient, once these supply shocks eased, you suddenly then get the growth, which you did. But then government introduced in this environment where we've had this difficult period and growth had been weak and confidence had been knocked on several occasions, a government which should have come in and said something along the lines of, use a bit of Reaganism here, it's morning in Britain.
Yeah.
We've got some problems with the budget and we've found a black hole, but you know what? We were the party that built the NHS in the economic ruins of the Second World War. What's 20 billion to us? Household balance sheets are good, banks are well capitalized, businesses are in good shape, we've got fundamentally a well-regulated economy. The world is improving, or at least the external environment is. People should have the confidence to go and spend. We're going to backstop this. And they didn't. They introduced this sense of foreboding by saying, we've got difficult decisions, taxes are going to have to go up, and all this other stuff. Now, you can say, well, how much is the government to blame for being honest? Well, first, I think it's naive from a policymaker's perspective not to understand that confidence plays a huge role in economic performance.
It sort of felt a little bit like a new football CEO or a new football manager
kitchen sinking
all the bad news in the first quarter.
That's exactly right.
Getting the share price down so that you can cash in on your options in the last 2-3 years, closer as the election comes along. And it's fine to come back to the point about Trump running America Inc. It's fine for a company, not for an economy that's made up of millions of people, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So people should have had the confidence then to invest. And, your point around the savings ratio rising in the second half of the year, the curious thing is there is you have the Bank of England reducing interest rates.
Yeah.
And what should be a feel-good factor from a new government and a changing government, which is important after 14 years, you should have seen suddenly this unleashing of animal spirits. And instead, the government trampled the animal spirits.
Mm.
Now, there's a point here which is, I think, worth making. The first is, there's always for governments a process of learning by doing.
Yeah.
They tend to start off popular, but frankly a bit incompetent. Mm. And then over time, they develop incompetence and they become unpopular. It's normal, which is why so many unpopular governments get voted in for a second term, because in the end, they figure out how to run the economy. So I think that process is still playing out. I think that we're a little bit surprised at just how sensitive sentiment has been to the downside. There's another point, which is just process. The government could have got the process better. You have two fiscal announcements a year. One is typically about building an envelope for spending. You raise taxes or you adjust taxes and you set your borrowing. That's what autumn was about. It was never really about spending. It was about the envelope. The spending now comes in spring. And so we say, well, we've had this change in tune. We focused a lot on borrowing and taxes in autumn, and now suddenly we're focusing on spending. The government's listening. Actually, no. It's just going through the normal process. Mm. What it should have probably done is said, actually, we said a lot of things to win the election, but the reality is the economy is actually in good shape. We're not going to change too much too quickly. We'll work on regulations and we'll work on planning, try and inspire some confidence in businesses. And then once we've got a bit of an economic tailwind into this year, then maybe we can raise taxes a little bit. Maybe we can do some other things. The other thing to say is, and again, what scenario on policy requires the fewest assumptions is probably the scenario that you're heading. We made the point on Donald Trump and his business acumen, but from a Labour point of view, the UK fiscal position is not decidedly worse than other advanced economies. Mm-hmm. And yet when the bond market sells off, as we saw in January, UK bond market sells off by more, which suggests that the UK is paying a penalty for all the political uncertainty we saw through Brexit and Truss and Corbyn and all the rest of it, which means the bond market will seldom tolerate significantly more borrowing. Mm-hmm. So that's out of the question. Tax hikes are decidedly unpopular.
Yeah.
So further tax hikes are going to be quite difficult. So actually, government is now quite fiscally constrained. And we're looking at the next 4 years. What do they do? Well, actually, what businesses like and actually what voters might like and certainly what markets like is planning permission. Let's accelerate planning and let's deregulate. Now, I'm a bit skeptical of asking the regulators to deregulate themselves, but they've roughed up the regulators in various ways. Ideally, some of them will be combined, so there's a bit of kind of regulatory cannibalism. But that's a direction that markets like, because with deregulation, what you can do is you can do exactly the same things as you did before, but with fewer legal costs. So it goes straight into margins. And you go through these waves every now and again, where the global financial crisis was probably a signal that we needed to focus a bit more on, say, consumer protections and shoring up the financial system. Maybe you do want to be a little risk averse for a while. Then it goes too far.
Yeah.
You need to move in the other direction.
15 years.
Yeah. And the paradoxical thing is, you know, if you want to avoid the risk of financial bubbles or consumer losses for whatever reason, if you overregulate that, you then encounter this bigger risk, which is the economy doesn't grow, you have productivity problems, your capital markets become dysfunctional, and so you overcompensate, and now we seem to be heading back in the other direction. And so government now seems to be finally facing in the right direction on some key things. I think it's reasonable to think that over the course of this year, the Bank of England cuts rates a few times. We're already seeing some economic surprises. The government makes a bit of progress on these two issues. You'll probably see that cyclical dynamic that we started to see last year reemerge.
And with that sort of surplus savings and things like that, if that starts to get deployed, if people do kind of improve in confidence, yeah, there is a fair bit of dry powder out there, isn't there?
Yes, there's no shortage of demand potential. Mm. It's what the UK remains is a supply constrained economy, and that's because we're so externally oriented.
And obviously, Chief Economist at Peel Hunt, UK's only investment bank. Was that right? Not quite right. UK's biggest investment bank.
Yeah, specialist investment bank.
Specialist
that's right.
Bank. Like, we've spoken a lot on this podcast about the death of the FTSE and the London equity market. Is there any? Do you see, from your vantage point, any hope? Hope is a strong word. That actually the London market is ready to be reinvigorated, or is it a continuing death by a thousand cuts?
Broadly speaking, the economic story that we discussed at the start, which is, you know, you go through these distinct phases where the US is the only game in town, and then you shift to US still looks good, it's the biggest, most dynamic economy in the world, but some other stuff looks sufficiently cheap that you may want to see some reallocation. I think this year we're going to see that process start, so I think that will be good for London, and we're already seeing outperformance actually in Europe versus the US since the start of the year. That's the first thing. There's one important point to make, which is that it's actually a bit surprising that the UK became such a financial hub in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and again, this is not a pessimist. It's important to, if you understand why you managed this in the first place, you have a better chance of solving the problems that we currently face now. So think about what capital markets essentially do is they match savings,
mm-hmm.
which are generated in the real economy, with factors of production, you know, capital, technology, energy, and potential for growth in factors of production, which is, we call it profit or real return on capital. Now, the UK, unlike the US, is not endowed with huge domestic factors of production.
Right.
I was like, it's not very big.
Yeah.
It's a bit of energy, but not lots of energy. We don't have lots of precious metals. We have nice coastline, but it's not a huge population, certainly not compared to some of the big populations we now see around the world. And yet, the UK, and this has been true for a long time, this is not a recent development, but yet the UK grew to be the biggest financial centre in the world. And in many markets it still is. And the UK market was a big market. But that big market, which grew, UK equity market, post-80s, coincided with a few things happening. First, global financial liberalisation. Capital was flowing around the world much more easily. A period of relative peace and stability,
yep.
when the war came down, and trade liberalisation, including the common market. So what you had is a situation where the UK was a good place to access all of the factors of production in the big European market in a lightly regulated, well-run economy with a favourable legal infrastructure.
Yep.
And so it didn't matter that you had this inconsistency between where the money was and where the factors of production were, because both could flow easily across borders, which is why for the single market, it's important that you have free movement of capital, goods, services, and people,
yeah.
for this reason. But what we've seen is, first in the UK, a shift towards financial regulation after the global financial crisis. So we've lost a competitive edge in capital markets. You've also seen the world become more multipolar. Geopolitics has returned. And we have these partly self-inflicted, Brexit, but partly, this is just the trend, rising global trade barriers. And so what you now have is, and this is the case in the US, a world in which the US, with its big factors of production, where it has the energy, it can continue to grow its companies during periods where Europe suffers gas shocks, as we've seen 2021 to 2023, because of these factors of production. And so it sucks in capital. Capital is going for risk-adjusted high returns. The UK in this environment struggles to compete with the US. So what you have to do is you need to do a few things. You need to accept that, one, the world has changed. And so we need to just address the fact that the world has changed. And it's not potentially that we have sins of commission, that is, we've made policy choices that were wrong. Mm. It's actually a sin of omission here, where we haven't changed as the world has. We've stayed the same, the world has changed. And that's a bigger explanation, I think, than anything else. The second thing, which for me is critical, is don't be seduced by the idea that if only you could just force capital to stay in the UK and push the market up, the economy would do better. I mean, that is a very seductive policy, but it's also the reason why history is littered with financial market bubbles and inflation. Yeah. If you could just get more money, everything would be better. No, is the answer. You need to fix the factors of production side and capital markets. So I'm in favor of policies which prime the pump, which is to say, if capital can move freely around the world, or more freely than trade, the speed bumps and frictions to global trade, which mean you can't just have your company in the UK and make the stuff elsewhere and it doesn't matter anymore. You actually need to make those frictions consistent across trade and capital markets. Mm-hmm. So you need to start looking at the tax regimes and things like ISA and say, well, actually, should we be getting a tax break invested in the US or in some other market where there are trade frictions, for instance? That's one thing. But then on the real economy side, you have to deal with the fact that we're not in the EU anymore. We don't have as easy access to all the European factors of production. And our own markets, which we have neglected, we're going to have to start to fix. So it does matter that the UK can produce its own domestic energy. It does matter that if we've got commodities under the ground, we start to dig them up. It actually does matter if we've got problems with planning and regulation. And so I'm sort of structurally encouraged that across all of UK politics, you have this consensus that probably do we need to regulate? We need to take our energy policy a little bit more seriously. We need to do all of these things. And so the way to fix capital markets, I think, is to do lots of things under the umbrella of saying the world has changed. We need to change our economy, but we have more strengths than weaknesses. So it's kind of an optimistic story.
Thatcherism story almost, isn't it? Because that's essentially what we went through in the 80s. That's
exactly right.
North Sea deregulation, Big Bang.
Yes.
We came out of our kind of post-imperial decline, if that was a thing, through the 60s and 70s. My reading of history was it was pretty grim. And we found our way in the 90s and noughties were both pretty good. Well, we became more comfortable, I suppose, as an economy, as in a country.
That's exactly right. I mean, I'm spending a lot of time looking at the role of energy, because when you talk about AI, AI is a technological trend, but in a way it's actually also an industrial cycle, because mm-hmm. it's so energy intensive. Mm-hmm. So, the big data centers, huge amounts of energy and water. And partly the reason why it's so good to do this stuff in America is because it's so rich in energy.
Yeah.
Per capita energy consumption in the US is almost twice what it is in the UK. There's a strong positive correlation between per capita energy consumption and per capita GDP. No major economy produces so much on a per capita basis relative to its energy consumption in the UK. Like, we are the world leader in energy efficiency in many respects.
Yeah.
But what I think people are unaware of, and it's work that I've been doing recently, is if you look at UK electricity supply, it rises through the 20th century right up until 2005. And it's declined since 2005 by 25%.
25%.
25%. The kink in the productivity story.
And our population's gone up by 10-20% since then.
Yes. And this is not just we demand less because the light bulbs and the machines don't produce as much heat as before, so like demand destruction through energy efficiency gains. Actually, what you see is in 2005, prices across industrial energy and consumer energy just start to ramp up. So you can see that supply is declining by more than demand. Why has this happened? Partly our energy policy, but we have been, and this is why planning is so important in this story, we've decommissioned coal and nuclear and some gas, roughly on schedule, but we've not built offsetting capacity on schedule. So what you see is this clear trend around the world that countries that raise their per capita energy consumption also raise their living standards, and that was our story. And then in 2005, when we start to reduce our electricity supply, suddenly we have this almost stagnation in productivity and continued deindustrialization. Now again, there's a hopeful story in all of this, which is if you look at the projections for UK energy capacity, mm-hmm. starting this year and right until the middle of the century, they start to rise significantly.
Okay. So is that all renewables, or is that mix?
It's
nuclear.
Predominantly renewables, but there's a big gas component.
How is that?
Because the intermittency of renewables requires some firm power.
Yeah.
So once you go through the cycle of, you know, all the additional layers of costs that are currently on energy prices in order to finance the transition towards clean energy, once you actually get the supply, some of these things can wash off. And so we've gone through a period of rising prices and declining supply, mm-hmm. which has hurt productivity and income growth, to a world in which actually supply should be rising and prices over the longer run can start to decline.
No, that's encouraging.
But we have to build this stuff on time.
It's something like over half of major infrastructure projects go to court, don't they? So you kind of, those barriers in terms of from a regulatory perspective are just so high.
That's right. But
what's it called judicial reviews. Judicial infrastructure.
That's right. You know, you can actually look at the data, and there are requirements for certain projects to receive a yes or no within 3 months, 6 months, depending on the size of the project. I looked at the data, and since 2010, I think I get this right, like between 80-90% of applications would get the decision in time. Now it's less than half. Mm. So we have a real problem with this. But again, government is pointing in the right direction, seems to be making some progress. What they could do is, maybe someone's listening, make a spectacle of it. You know, there's lots of ways in which it's not advisable to copy the US administration. One thing that is advisable is, you know, when President Trump is signing his executive orders with Sharpies and throwing the pens into the crowd, like, he's making a point of what he's doing. Do the same thing in the UK.
Well, we had that Ferrari over the Bat Tunnel up your way, wasn't it, on HS2, with £100 million spent on the Bat Tunnel. I mean, come on. There's your example. Use it.
That's it.
This is bonkers.
Just get a minister just to sit on Cheapside with a stack of papers where these are all the planning applications that are delayed or rejected by local councils, and just say, actually, we're going ahead with that. And just make, I mean, of course I'm joking there, but we need to make a bit of a spectacle, because it goes down to this point of animal spirits. If you can inspire the confidence to spend, things will be fine. I mean, I like, there's a great essay by John Maynard Keynes called Economic Prospects for Our Grandchildren. And he starts off by saying, we are suffering right now from a bad attack of economic pessimism. Mm-hmm. And he's writing in the around 1930, you're in the throes of the global depression. And he says, you know, it's commonplace for people to say today that all of the great gains in living standards of the 19th century won't be repeated in the 20th century. You know, living standards doubled in the 19th century. Yeah. They increased fivefold in the 20th century. He said, we're not suffering from rheumatic pains, basically an arthritic, old age, stiffening economy. So these are the adolescent growing pains of change that is happening faster than we can adapt. I think that's a good analogy for the way the world is today. Mm. You know, things are changing faster than we can adapt.
Yeah.
It's not that the economy is becoming ossified And deregulation is important in this because it allows the market to flex and adjust, and it allows the role of prices to dictate where scarce capital can go. And, you know, loss becomes just as an important signal as profit in this world. A little bit of creative destruction is quite. And so there's no smooth path to higher growth, stronger productivity. You know, we're going to have to accept that if growth is our priority, and it should be, we need to tolerate some frictional unemployment. We might need to spoil some of the, some of the horizons. We should feel a little bit less uneasy about digging commodities out of the ground, maybe exploring North Sea oil and gas. Once we start to move in this direction, and I think probably actually the worm has turned, judging by what you see across UK, all of UK politics, I think we're probably going to get there.
That's encouraging. Very encouraging, hopeful. Sam, have you got any more questions before we wrap?
No, very comprehensive.
Very good. I like that. Bad attack of economic pessimism. That's the title sorted. Callum, thank you. Sam, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for watching and listening today. Any questions, get in touch. Jonathan.raymond@courtachievit.com, and we hope to see you next time. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.